how do manias die? My sense is they die very quietly. It's people not talking. The way they don't die is people in positions of power reversing their positions in public. That's not ever what happens. They're never going to disavow it. They're never going to say, excuse me, this was wrong, and let's not let it happen again. No. We went immediately from COVID to climate change. And now that's all we want to talk about. Maybe we went a little nuts, but we're never going to acknowledge it. We're just going to get nuts about something else.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Lionel Shriver. Lionel, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you again.
It's always great to have you on. I feel like there is always stuff for us to talk about, crazy things usually. Speaking of crazy things, I want to ask you about your new novel, which is called Mania. And it's a brilliant setup, story-wise. This is about a world in which everyone is now seen as being equally intelligent, and there is this thing called cognitive discrimination, where you're not allowed to discriminate against people on the basis of their intelligence. And it's about the last great civil rights movement, which is the uprising for treating everyone as if they were cognitively equal, intelligently equal. Great setup for this novel called Mania. Could you tell us a little bit more about it? What inspired you to write this story? What you want to try and get through to the reader in this story?
Well, I was especially responding to what I perceived as a sequence of social manias that have taken us by storm within the course of about 10 years, starting in 2012, which is when I identify our obsession with transgenderism starting to take off. It's a little arbitrary. You could say 2011 or 2013. If you look at the figures with the NHS take up of people who suddenly decide they're transgender, it's right around 2012 it really starts to escalate. From nothing to, you know, everything. And that was followed by, you know, the Me Too movement, which went international in very short order. Look at what happened as well with COVID. Certainly COVID lockdowns. We'd never locked down before in face of any disease. And suddenly that's what every country is doing. And literally overnight in the UK, we had most of the population perfectly happy to abdicate every civil right that they had considered their birthright the day before, literally the day before. And then there was the Black Lives Matter business, which, you know, really only took a couple of days to go international. And it became a huge mania, even in countries that didn't have any Black people to speak of, which was especially weird. That irrationality is one of the signs that it's a social mania and not just a, you know, a strong, important social movement. It's a kind of derangement. And I'd also suggest, which we can talk about, that the climate change obsession is definitely another one. And so just taking that little step back, I was looking at everyone going nuts around me and thinking the same things and even using the same language over and over again. I found myself a little outside of all of these things, kind of watching. It's like, what happened to everyone? So I was motivated to write the book because of the larger phenomenon of our susceptibility to sudden social derangement. You know, human beings have always been prey to this kind of contagion, but I think it's worse than ever. I know we blame social media for everything, so it's boring, but we might as well blame social media for this too. And therefore, in order to examine the phenomenon, I decided to get behind all those manias that I just cited. And so I started the book in an alternative 2011. And I invented my own mania. And given the left's obsession with equality, this whole thing of suddenly we regard everyone as equally intelligent and you can't discriminate on the basis of, you know, IQ or any kind of mental ability, that's only a millimeter from where we are now. And, you know, I'm disturbed by the war on merit. I think it endangers us all. It endangers the functionality of our society. It endangers our ability to walk into a doctor's office and be sure that they're not going to cut our head off. So I thought it was a timely subject, but it was also a lot of fun. And I should clarify that it is a novel. It's not a treatise. And it's not just a mechanical working out of what that premise would do to our society, but it's also about a relationship between two women. They've been good friends ever since high school. And little by little, they start to get on opposite sides of this movement. And it has a catastrophic effect on their friendship. And because I have lost friends through this politically polarized period, and it's been quite painful, I thought there were a lot of other people out there who have lost friends, almost always people to the right who have lost friends to the left. And I wanted to explore the way in which politics is infecting our relationships and alienating us from each other.
Absolutely. And I often think that dystopias or social satires, I don't know how you would describe your new novel Mania, but they work best when they are, as you've just said, a millimeter away from what's going to happen next, when they really capture something that's in the process, something that you could really imagine happening next in our societies that are already messed up. And you're absolutely right that even an idea such as a society that refuses to discriminate on the basis of IQ, in other words, which refuses to say, well, this person's very intelligent, let's give him or her the job, you know, you can really see a situation where we're moving towards that. Because if you think about DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, we already have this industrial scale ideological system, which is devoted to judging people and promoting people less according to their intelligence or their aptness or their character or how good they are at what we want them to do, and more about judging them according to their ethnic heritage, their national background, their sex, and so on. So through something like DEI, we're already moving towards that kind of nightmare vision that you write about in your new novel, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, if you take a look at the story of Claudine Gay, the now abruptly retired president of Harvard, I thought the larger story about Claudine Gay was not just, you know, her ineptness in testifying before Congress, not even her plagiarism. It was the exposure of the fact that Harvard had hired a president who had no business being president of any institution, much less what regarded itself as the most preeminent university in the United States, if not the world. She didn't have the credentials. She'd never written a book. Clearly, her only real qualifications had to do with, you know, being Black. She was what I call a professional Black person, and there are a lot of them out there. And it pays very well, $900,000 a year in this case. But, you know, you're left looking at this and saying, how did this happen? Well, that is DEI in action. Someone's qualifications are irrelevant. Their abilities are irrelevant. All that matters is they tick the box. And, you know, this was a very high profile example of what DEI is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about manias and crazes and what they are and how they happen. So the four that you outlined, and I've seen you writing and speaking about these in the past few weeks, and I have found what you've been saying so convincing and such a useful way to understand the moment that we're living through. And those four in particular that you've mentioned, trans, Me Too, the COVID lockdowns, and Black Lives Matter. And as you say, we might throw in the fifth one of climate alarmism. That's a very useful framework for understanding the various things that are happening within and to our societies. But I did want to ask you a few questions on how these things come about. How do they take root, and how do they take root so quickly? As you say, in the COVID lockdowns, from one day to the next, we went from pretty much cherishing our civil liberties to quite willingly giving them up. Or if you look at the Me Too moment, the way you've described it, I think quite aptly, is that you had some accusations against a nasty big wig in Hollywood, and then suddenly, Harvey Weinstein, that is, and then suddenly, overnight, women across the Western world were giving voice to all sorts of experiences they had, from the serious to if we're being frank, the frivolous. Every single relationship or mishap, regretted sex or bad date they had was suddenly being confessed in the public sphere in this very strange way. So the speed with which these things take hold, the way in which they rise to the surface of society quite quickly, I want to ask you a few questions on how you think this happens. You've mentioned social media, but it can't just be social media, can it? There must be other forces at work which make us susceptible to these crazes in the way that you describe.
You know, I think identifying how these things come about is really difficult, and I don't have any simple explanation or set of procedures through which these contagions establish themselves in societies, much less all over the world, which is what's happening now. And one of the signature elements of a mania in full flow is that it doesn't seem like a mania at the time. It just seems like the truth. It's just, oh, this is what's happening. This is what's important. This is what we're supposed to think about and what we're supposed to say. Whatever that message is, it communicates itself with incredible rapidity and through all kinds of different media. It isn't just social media. It's also the mainstream media. It's these signals that come in from everywhere. I mean, I look back around 2012, suddenly there were all these documentaries on television about little boys wearing dresses. And at that time, it was mostly little boys. And nobody had ever talked about this stuff before. I mean, it was just an obscure little interest involving small, tiny, tiny number of people who were unhappy with their sex and tried to live as the other. Curiosities, if you will. And certainly regarded by the medical establishment as people who were mentally ill. And then I just wonder, how did this come about? You know, how were all the messaging systems coordinated? But also, how was it simultaneously communicated in a way that had a profound effect on me and what I wrote and said in public? You are not supposed to differ with this ideology. You are not supposed to point out anything wrong with it. If you say the smallest discouraging word about this phenomenon, which is supposed to be so wonderful and we're supposed to be promoting, then you will be crucified. And that was the case too. And it was so effective. It was so immediately clear that you couldn't say anything that I, who, you know, I pride myself on being immune to this stuff, and I fancy myself also terribly brave, or maybe a better word is stupid. And yet I had enough social canniness to keep my mouth shut on this issue for a good 4 years. And I look back on that with astonishment. And you have to remember also that what seems to be breaking now, and in general, the Overton window widened a little bit, I think about 3 or 4 years ago. And finally, you could start saying, you know, isn't this a little warped? Or, you know, what might these kids grow out of it? Or, my God, you're making them sexually dysfunctional and infertile for life. Is this a good idea to do to children? You know, it became possible to say that. But don't forget how absolutely against the rules it was to say anything up until that point. And you would lose your job and you would not be able to publish anything. I mean, it was an absolute rule. So when I finally wrote something about it in 2016, this was before, you know, the rules changed a little bit. I knew I was doing something extremely dangerous. Now, what's fascinating to me is how, therefore, not only did the contagion itself spread, but so did the message, you better keep your mouth shut if you have a problem with it. And that's, you know, that's the same with climate change. You don't want to be regarded as a denier, and you're going to suffer serious professional consequences if you question the climate narrative.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
I do want to ask you about the other manias, especially the lockdown one. But the trans one is a good example of a good issue through which to explore how these things take hold, but more importantly, how they spread, how the contagion spreads. Because one of the things that was most striking to me about the trans mania, and it really is a form of mania, when you have relatively significant numbers of young people submitting themselves to the most extraordinary forms of mutilation and bodily mortification and the purging of their sinful or incorrect sex and their replacement of it with this kind of pretend sex, this fake sex. It does echo the way in which some female saints behaved in the medieval era when they would very often purge their female bodies. They would cut their breasts, they would scald their private parts, they had this kind of violent contempt for their own womanhood, and they would often take extreme measures in order to prove their godliness, to try and be closer to the male specimen in order that they might be closer to God. So that was a mania among sections of female society in the 14 and 1500s. And you see a very similar mania today amongst growing numbers of girls, as you say. Ellen Page, for example, successful young actress. If you read her autobiography, it's entirely like the biography of a medieval saint in terms of how it describes what Ellen Page did to her body, the deprivations and the violence she visited on her own body. So definitely a kind of mania, unquestionable. But I wonder, what role do the institutions of society play in allowing a mania to go from being something that might be done by a handful of unhinged people to being something that becomes a social phenomenon with real force? So the way in which the NHS rolled over in response to all of this, the police, the army, hedge funds, banks, the political class, all of whom were waving the trans flag and repeating the trans mantras, trans women are women, etc. To what extent is their cowardice or their search for a sense of virtue a complicit force in allowing the cranky behavior of small numbers of people to become a social phenomenon?
Oh, I think you've put your finger on it. That's really what makes the mania take hold, is that the institutions that are supposed to hold the line and have a larger view of a society's well-being and therefore not allow the entire country or locality to be captured by a goofball idea, they've completely capitulated in every single instance. And, you know, in the wake of Black Lives Matter, which could have been just a temporary, you know, explosion of insistence on justice, fair enough, it would have been ultimately pretty harmless, aside from the fact that it spawned on an institutional level this obsession with DEI. And that is now deeply ingrained in universities, in government. The first thing Joe Biden did was to appoint a cabinet and set of staff that were all about diversity, not qualifications, right? Nobody, when he appointed his cabinet, said, oh, this Native American whatever it has these qualifications, and that's why she's been appointed to this role in the health service or whatever. No mention of that. It was all about identity. The way in which institutions, and let's put it plainly, what controls institutions? People. So you're actually talking about people in positions of power who are as susceptible to being swept up in what everyone is supposed to say and what everyone is supposed to think, whatever that is. They're just as prey to social contagion as everyone else. And they're just as cowardly as everyone else. That's what makes a mania dangerous. If there's nothing wrong with a bunch of kooks on the side deciding the world is flat, I mean, and they can worry about walking too far and falling off. That's their problem. But it is a problem when every level of your society, every institution of your society embraces that. And I do think that one of the most forbidding examples is the National Health Service embracing what is ultimately a misogynistic vocabulary in order to please the trans activists. You know, that whole business of people with a cervix or birthing people. I mean, it's grotesque. And the same thing has happened in the United States, so that it's now completely normal on newscasts never to talk about pregnant women. Basically, it's become a style issue. It's that deep.
Yeah, the misogynistic language of it all is extraordinary. But I wanted to ask you on the question of people in positions of power, and you say that they are just as susceptible to the spread of these mania as the rest of us. I wonder if it might be fair to say that they're more susceptible, because I did want to ask you about who is responsible for these manias, but also who is allowing the manias to sweep over them most of all. So if you look, for example, at, I guess, all four of those manias, lockdown is slightly different. And I do want to ask you specifically about lockdown, because that was something that huge numbers of people bought into, sometimes in a very uncritical way. But if we look at the other three, trans, Me Too, BLM, it did seem to me that they were very often the pathologies of the upper sections of society. So if you look at the trans idea, for example, you know, when I speak to normal people in my life, young people buy into it, unquestionably. They often have the pronouns in their bio and so on. Middle class, upper middle class people buy into it. It's the way in which you demonstrate your moral fitness for polite society very often is by saying trans women are women. It becomes something you have to adopt in order to be a member of the in-group. But there are other people out there, older people, ordinary working people, who will very often say, this is a load of bollocks, isn't it? This is just not true. And that person is not, Eddie Izzard isn't a woman. That makes no sense. And you see that on the other manias as well, although lockdown is a slightly separate one. Do you think there are some people who are more susceptible than others to this stuff? And do you think there is still a section of society out there who, even if they might be a very silent majority, they are kind of holding the tidal wave back, at least in their own lives and at least in their own homes and their own families?
Yeah, I think a lot of what spreads this is competition for status. And however the message goes out at the top, you get it sometimes earlier than other people, which is one of the reasons you're a successful person and in a position of power, because you get the signals, you pick up what's in your interest, and you know how to promote those interests. And it's like, oh, if I get out ahead of everyone else and talk about how important it is to employ Black people, regardless of their qualifications, in as great a number as possible, then I'm going to be admired. I'm going to keep my job rather than lose it. In spite of that, we're going to fire everyone else in order to hire all those Black people. It is a survival mechanism. It is how you gain status and power or keep it. And it's been interesting to watch, for example, because these manias are not exclusive to each other. I mean, they interact a little bit. And I think that as the obsession with race has grown, especially in the United States, the trans thing came along and it presented white middle class and often upper middle class families and parents with an opportunity for getting in on the identity politics gravy train. In other words, if you had a trans kid, it was, you know, the ultimate status item. It sure beat, you know, a designer handbag. And it definitely beat a gay kid. a gay kid was passé, and at the same time, I don't think had entirely lost its stigma. So that's the worst of all possible worlds. It's still a little bit shameful, but at the same time, it's not out there in the forefront of the civil rights movement. Everyone thinks, okay, you've got a gay kid, he's got civil rights, now he can get married if he wants to. Not interesting. Still somehow a little disappointing, isn't it? So the trans kid solved this whole thing. And it also meant that, you know, white parents could claim to be part of an important and vanguard civil rights movement. You know, you had this phenomenon of particular locations. It's usually urban blue cities in the U.S., where the number of trans kids was huge in comparison to the rest of the country. Part of it was that communicating within the locality, that social contagion, but it also had to do with the nature of a certain kind of parent. And I've listened to all kinds of whistleblowers from these gender clinics say exactly this, that there was a certain kind of parent they learned to recognize. They jumped on the idea that they had a trans kid. They obviously loved it. It meant that sometimes a kid who was really not fitting in, not doing great, didn't have a lot of friends, suddenly was hugely popular and got all the special attention from the educational establishment. It was a very sly status move. And I think that if you're looking at it on the upper levels, what we now call the elite, that's a lot of it, is that people who are very ambitious and place a big emphasis on the kind of regard that they garner from others are most susceptible to this, because as soon as they figure out, oh, this is how I get ahead, this is how I secure my position, this is how I get people to admire me, then they adopt the whole orthodoxy.
Yeah. A competition for status is a very good way of putting it. And, you know, the trans kids phenomenon is such a striking one because, as you say, it happens in certain sections of society. And often the unwitting consequence of it is this wave of unspoken, possibly unintentional homophobia, essentially, where, you know, lots of kids who would quite likely have turned out to be young gay men or young lesbians are transed and medically and sometimes even surgically corrected, in quote marks, in order to become the correct sex. So you give rise to a pre-modern assault on the rights of gay kids, as we would have understood it just a few years ago, in order that people might achieve a certain status by having a more interesting, exotic child. That, again, in itself, isn't it, is proof of the destructive nature of some of these manias. I guess in the moment, it seems to people that they're doing something good. They're certainly doing something good for their own moral prestige and their own social prestige. But whether unwittingly or just because they're so entranced by dogma that they're not thinking straight, they're actually doing something quite destructive, both in their own lives and in society more broadly.
Oh, I think it's important to note about all these things is that these social hysterias are instigated by and promoted by people who believe they have the very best of intentions. It isn't actually overtly malign. It often has horribly malign consequences, but you know, there's nothing more dangerous than righteousness. These consuming obsessions, the people behind them, they really believe that they are pursuing goodness, that they are improving society, that this is an important cause, that, you know, for most of the people behind lockdowns, I know you want to save that for later, but for most of the people behind lockdowns, they thought they were saving lives. They really did. Now, I don't think they did, actually. I think they cost lives. It's an opinion, but an informed one. But I wouldn't accuse the powers that be of deliberately going out to kill people or merely being motivated to exercise their power to close up their societies and keep everyone home out of a kind of sadism. That's what's baffling about these things. and deeply disturbing. I mean, even the climate lobby, you know, they think we're all about to die. Well, I don't share that view. And I think having that view has all kinds of unintended and terrible consequences, not least of which is we're heading for not having any electrical power and having everything that we own be powered by electricity. Little problems like that. But point being, it's driven by virtue. It's out of control virtue. It's under-examined virtue. And it's a kind of groupsteristic version of virtue so that you believe it's good because everyone else says it's good without really taking a look at it. Most problems, if it is a problem, they're going to be complicated. It's not going to have a simple answer. The climate, for example, is hugely complex beyond our ability to construct a computer program that will imitate it. But people don't like complicated answers to things. So that's another problem, that people are attracted to the simplistic. You know, during Me Too, it seemed as if you could reduce male-female relations to men are all assholes and treat women atrociously, and finally the women have had enough. And that was it. There was no more complication than that. And that's, you know, that's kind of gratifying for women up to a point. It also meant that we didn't have any agency, and everything wrong with our lives is someone else's fault. You examine it a little, and it's not actually a very pretty paradigm. But you brought up something that I want to return to, because what's especially strange, I would say that this comes back to transgenderism, is when, okay, you've got the elite that have embraced this mania and left everyone else behind, so that the vast majority of people don't know what you're talking about or think that this thing is kind of weird. And yet it still takes hold. It still controls what happens. It still controls the national discourse, and the vast majority of what we refer to as ordinary people, well, they might get the message to keep their mouths shut, but they don't go along with it. I mean, I find it heartening. I find it heartening when something comes along that is crazy, and the large majority of people say, I'm not buying it. This is nuts. I mean, that means that there's hope for the future. I think, by contrast, lockdowns did have huge buy-in. And because of such a huge popular buy-in, we're having a very hard time debunking this approach to a pandemic, which I think is really important because there will be another pandemic. And we have to have come to the conclusion that these preventive measures didn't work. And we need a completely different paradigm for dealing with disease on a mass scale.
Yeah, so let's talk about lockdown. We've talked about lockdown before. You were one of the very early critics of lockdown, and
March 2020,
right at the start. And there were a handful of other people. Spiked was putting forward some critical perspectives as well, but we were very small in number. All of us were attacked in various different ways, and it was very much a crazed moment in terms of what society was doing to itself. But even more importantly than that was just the crushing of any form of dissent or any form of questioning or any form of analysis. And I wanted to ask you, as you say, quite rightly, there was a far larger buy-in to lockdown than there has been with some of these other manias. No doubt that was partly because it became part of the law, or certainly part of the pretty stringent government advice, that there were certain things we were allowed to do and certain things we weren't allowed to do. But there was a large element of complicity with a lot of those rules and regulations, and with the whole idea that we should be put under house arrest as the best way to tackle this new virus. I did actually want to ask you also how manias die, not only how they come to life, but how they die or how they fizzle out. Because one thing that struck me about the lockdown phenomenon, it does seem that there's an element of almost social amnesia now in relation to lockdown. One thing I've noticed when I speak to friends and family who have normal, good, productive jobs in the real world, we very rarely talk about lockdown. You know, when you meet friends, you always have a trip down memory lane. You always say, do you remember that thing that happened 5 years ago? Do you remember that thing that happened 20 years ago? Tripping down memory lane is very, very common when you hang out with people you know. But it never happens with lockdown. People never say, do you remember when we weren't allowed to leave the house for 6 months? Or do you remember when they put yellow tape on park benches? Or do you remember when they wouldn't let us go to the park and they set up a hotline so you could snitch on your neighbours? People very rarely reminisce on those things. And actually, I find that a lot of people are forgetting them already. And I often remind people and say, listen, do you remember we were only allowed to leave the house once a day? And they set up a special police hotline so that people could grass on you if you left your house more than once a day. And people kind of forget it. Do you think there's an element of regret in society in relation to the lockdown mania? And possibly people's way of dealing with it is to stop talking about it. How do you think people are coping with the aftermath of lockdown and the question of what we did to ourselves as a society?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, I've picked up the same thing. It's almost as if it's been redacted.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the entirety of 2020 through 2022 has a black marker through it, and we don't want to look at it. It's true that we don't like to revisit the disagreeable, but I think there's more going on than that. One of the things I also remember is that especially the first lockdown, because the weather in the UK was so fantastic, people were having a wonderful time. And they loved not having to work and getting money for nothing. We are still dealing with the hangover of that because it was so fun that nobody wants to give it up. So it's not strictly a matter of not wanting to go back to something that was so awful. I think there is an element of shame. I think whether people are conscious of it or not, and that evasion that you're picking up suggests it isn't conscious. But then shame doesn't have to be, does it? And there's a sneaky little feeling that we all went along with something that was, in retrospect, a little nuts, completely inconsistent, utterly ineffective, and also a regime that very few people stood up to. And that is shameful. At the time, there was a small group of Americans in red states that protested over the lockdowns. And I was greatly relieved at that. They got bad press, of course. It was, you know, oh, these atrocious barbarians who want everyone to die. It was a relief to see somebody getting a little irked, right?
Yeah.
Whereas you saw very little of it in the UK. And Spiked was one of the only places that said, excuse me, is this a good idea? And yeah, I think that in the recovery, we're just blotting it out because there was so little courage shown. And yet, my guess is that most people still believe that lockdowns were called for. And in that case, I suppose would support doing them again. There's been such a hangover of the financial consequences, the inflation because of all that excessive government spending, money created from nothing, all the healthcare consequences, the NHS in crisis. I mean, we don't need to go on and on, but the consequences have been severe and impossible to ignore, even on an individual level. You can't get a GP appointment. Your surgery, your knee replacement is going to happen 4 years from now, supposedly. And so there's a feeling that there has been a terrible price to pay, and there's very little to show for it. I mean, collectively, there's something going on of recognition of, well, that was a little nutty, wasn't it? And a sense of people gradually coming to their senses. You raise the general question of how do manias die? In my sense, is they die very quietly, quietly, slowly, and tacitly. That is, it's people not talking. The way they don't die is people in positions of power reversing their positions in public. That's not ever what happens. And what also doesn't happen is anyone apologizing. You'll never get any apologies. You never get any recognition from the people who have really gone nuts with this stuff. Whatever the mania is, they're never going to disavow it. They're never going to say, excuse me. It turns out that there were all kinds of terrible consequences to the position that I promoted, and I would like to make amends, or at the very least acknowledge this was wrong and let's not let it happen again. No. Also, you never have people held to account. So all the people who brought in lockdowns, they're fine. And they're never going to pay a price. And you look at what's happening to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in the United States, which promoted all kinds of lies during COVID. And, you know, little by little, they're actually acknowledging in their tiny, quiet way on the web, never going out in public and giving an interview. It's just sort of printing things. The authorities do not ever recognize they were caught by a mania. They were wrong. And that's what's so weird about when a mania subsides, is that it's all unofficial, all just, oh, we're not talking about that anymore. Can't we just change the subject? Or can't we just move on and get obsessed with something else? And that's, of course, what has happened with climate change. We went immediately from COVID to Black Lives Matter to climate change. And now that's all we want to talk about. So never mind all that other stuff. Maybe we went a little nuts, but we're never going to acknowledge it. We're just going to get nuts about something else.
That is an excellent description of how manias die. And you've put into words what I've been thinking about how if they do die, and sometimes they do, they tend to fizzle out and people just look the other way. And there's a shamefacedness, but it's never really a spoken one. And the problem with that, of course, is that we never have a real reckoning with what happened. And even the COVID inquiry is not a real reckoning with what happened. But what I found speaking to people is that, and this is, I think, probably a testament to how deranged that particular mania was, is that I sometimes wonder if I myself am going mad. So I was having a conversation with a friend fairly recently where they were justifying some of the measures that were taken. And I was saying, but don't you remember the time that the police in the Peak District dyed a lake black in order to discourage people from walking by it and force them to stay at home? And he said to me, that didn't happen. You've made that up. And I thought to myself, oh, maybe I did make it up. So I Googled it and it really did happen. Police in the Peak District, it's near Buxton. There's a beautiful turquoise lake. During lockdown, people were walking their dogs by it and taking a stroll. And the police dyed it black. They boasted about this and said, we have dyed this beauty spot black in order to discourage you from going anywhere near it and forcing you to stay at home. And when things like that happen, I mean, if you put that in a dystopian novel about a society that had lost its bearings, people would probably think that was too far into the realm of imagination. But it really did happen in our society in March 2020. Desecration of nature in order to punish the citizens and encourage them to stop looking at this beautiful thing and instead to stay home and watch the TV news and hear about how many people have died. Don't you think there's often an unwillingness, precisely the kind of tacit nature of the fizzling out of manias, as you very well describe it, there's an unwillingness or at least a flat-out failure to have a reckoning with how mad our societies have gone over the past few years and how we might avoid doing that in the future?
What we're talking about, it is society-wide, and therefore it involves so many people. There's so much complicity. There's so many people to hold accountable. I mean, if you wanted to hold people accountable for lockdowns, how would you do it? I mean, it's the entire British political establishment. It's the entire American political establishment with a few states excepted. What would you do to them all? I mean, and even on a popular level, so many people have gone along with it that there's a too high a price to pay to recognize, oh, I got on board with that and that was a little nuts. And that creates a self-mistrust that is uncomfortable. We'd all like to imagine that we are independent thinkers and we make decisions on our own, on the merits. That's very important to me about myself. I'm also a human being. My detractors wouldn't believe that, but I surely have my blind spots and am likely to sign on to this, that, and the other thing that in retrospect is a bit nuts. And there's actually a line in near the end of Mania where the narrator confesses that she may indeed have a variety of cuckoo beliefs, but she doesn't know what they are. So she can't tell you. Your version of reality entails certain versions of the way things are that you take so much for granted that it never even occurs to you to question them. So the whole phenomenon of the social mania is upsetting to our understanding of ourselves, that we want to be independent, wise people who look at the evidence, that we're not conformists. What we believe is not simply controlled by what other people believe, but to a horribly large degree, that is the case. And it's probably the case with me too, to coin a phrase.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show. There's another way, of course, in which manias die as well, which is less through the kind of fizzling out or just throwing a blanket over it and hoping that people forget about it. And people sometimes do forget about it. The other way is people take action intellectually or physically in the world that says, look, you've gone too far now, we're going to do something about this. And I think a good example of that is the trans one. And as you say, the Overton window on trans has shifted maybe 3 or 4 years ago. There is now more space for critical commentary, for discussion. And that really is down in large part to the unwillingness of many women and men to put up with this. You were an early critic back in 2016. Spiked was an early critic of some of this stuff too. We saw the misogynistic element of it, the homophobic element of it, the profoundly illiberal, irrational element of it fairly early on, I think. And there were other voices as well. And of course, then you have the voice like J.K. Rowling who gets involved, and that has an immeasurable impact on the willingness of other people to think a bit differently. Is that a reason for hope, do you think, that even in an era of manias, the capacity of people to stand up and give the more reasoned take and to say this is going too far, this is becoming far too destructive and it's built on a tissue of lies, the capacity of that to shift the discussion or open the window a bit is still there, even in these quite deranged moments?
Yes, there are little watershed moments, and I think that with the trans issue, we're in one right now. The issuance of the Cass report has already had a huge effect on what newspapers feel free to publish. You know, strong dissenting views on the whole phenomenon in a way that wouldn't have been possible last week. And it's someone in authority saying, well, basically acting like a grown-up and saying, hold on here, this is not evidence-based. Nobody's following what happens to these kids. This is medically irresponsible. There are all kinds of identifiable harms and yet virtually no identifiable benefits. So this is not being driven by medical necessity and the Hippocratic Oath. This is a cult. And this is driven by ideology. I'm not sure the Cass report actually uses the word cult, but it's implied. I'm afraid the United States, though, is behind the curve on this, and no such watershed has been reached. And you've got the Biden administration behind the whole trans thing hugely, including inserting faux women in women's sports. It's deeper there, and it's going to take a lot longer to get rid of it. But you know, that there is something about the kind of mania we're talking about, because it's at its root irrational. Irrational, not based on evidence, based on passion. some view of the world that suddenly seems to explain everything or is attractive for one reason or another, if only that it seems new, they always die eventually because the irrationality eventually reveals itself. There's a hollowness or an inconsistency in thinking this way and proceeding according to these assumptions that just doesn't work in the long term. And I found it useful to take a look at the recovered memory phenomenon, which started in the late 1980s in the United States and spread to the rest of Europe, actually, in the 1990s. And it's another one of those things we don't like to think about anymore, right? Well, it's just a little weird, and we don't go there. But it came from the therapeutic so-called community, and it was the case that, you know, there were many of these adults who had been sexually abused as children, sometimes even as babies. And if you gave them the right kind of therapy, then they could be able to dredge up memories that they had buried, because people don't want to remember things that are bad. But deep down in their psyches, these memories are still there, and they can be coaxed to the surface. And, you know, thousands of people went to therapists and were convinced by their therapist that they had been abused, usually by their parents or a parent, and that they remembered this terrible experience of having their father do oral sex on them when they were 3 months old. You can't even form memories when you're 3 months old, by the way. And it destroyed families because, you know, the person who suddenly remembered this abuse makes a declaration that you did this terrible thing to me, and it explains everything that ever went wrong with my life. It's a good example of that attraction to the simple explanation for everything. It's one of the things that made this movement tick. It died in the same way, in that quiet way. There were plenty of studies that really came to the conclusion that these poor patients who were suggestible had these memories basically implanted in them by their therapist. So little by little, the practice of doing that kind of deep dive into the psyche for all these terrible memories just moved on. Now, the therapist never said, oh God, we did terrible damage, and I'm so sorry. And, you know, we're going to pass some rules in our profession that you don't use this kind of therapy ever again. We're going to go on television, and I'm going to talk to the same newscaster that I talked to, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, talking about how important this therapy was. You know, this kind of testimony of these so-called memories were actually accepted in U.S. courts as factual testimony for several years. So you didn't ever have these people going on TV and saying, you know, we were mistaken. This has been incredibly destructive. Nope. Shut up. They did a different kind of therapy. And I'm not convinced that there were a lot of patients who came back to their families and said, you know, that was wrong. That never happened to me. It was obviously a false memory implanted by my therapist. I'm sorry I caused you so much anguish. Can we patch things up? I'm not convinced.
Yeah, I think the recovered memory movement is such a good example, an early example of modern society's susceptibility to manias and crazes and to incredibly destructive forms of intervention into people's lives. It was really rampant in the United States, but in Britain, we also got the recovered memory movement to a certain extent. We got the satanic ritual abuse panic. You know, there was the Orkney child abuse panic and in Cleveland as well, where very often large numbers of children were taken away from their families on the basis of events that simply didn't happen. And, you know, taking a child away from their parents is just about the most serious thing a state can do. A very good example of the destructive nature of some of these crazes. And we're seeing it repeated in different ways in the different manias. A couple more questions for you. I did want to ask you what you think has become of Me Too, because it's very interesting to me. If we look at those four manias that you've been talking about, the fact that they might be fizzling out or not fizzling out in different ways. So the transmania is being confronted intellectually and politically by a pretty good movement for reason and truth. So that's kind of been battled down. The lockdown mania is kind of just melting into a culture of amnesia, I fear. The Black Lives Matter mania, as you said earlier, is being kind of institutionalized under DEI. So that's kind of being put into the institutions, that's being given a position of power, although they might call it something different. And I wanted to ask you what you think's happened with the Me Too mania, because that's a very important part of all of this. And it was incredibly culturally powerful for a period of time. It was also staggeringly hypocritical. You know, if you were a Hollywood actress or a very well-to-do British journalist, you would get the front pages of the papers if you said that you had been abused by a man. But if you were a working class girl from the north of England who may have been subjected to abuse by largely Pakistani heritage grooming gangs, no one was in the slightest bit interested. They just wouldn't pay attention to you at all, to such an extent that that abuse could often carry on with no commentary whatsoever. So there was hypocrisy in it too. But what has become of Me Too? Is it taking a different feministic form? What's your reading of what happened to that mania in particular?
Well, off the lot, in some ways, it was the smallest, and I think it's lasted the least amount of time. And I think it has died down. I thought the response to Christine Blasey Ford's memoir that was just published this spring was quite telling. Why anyone would want to read a book by that woman, I don't know. Just to remind everyone, this is the woman who testified against Supreme Court nominee, now Justice Kavanaugh, testifying to the fact that when she was 15, Kavanaugh assaulted her at a party. The details were kind of unimpressive because he didn't actually do anything to her. And as far as I can tell, what she described could have happened in 10 to 15 seconds. You know, she was lauded as this courageous feminist who has, you know, braved facing her own trauma from her adolescence, from which she had never recovered. And now nobody wants to hear from her. Nobody's interested in her memoir. And it's been very poorly reviewed. It's quite, you know, it's been, the reception has been dismissive and kind of get out of our face. And she feels like yesterday's news. And I find that something of a relief because I watched that testimony and I thought it was pathetic. And I thought she was a very poor excuse for a feminist. She was whiny and timid and fearful. So I was quite an odd woman out in my perception of her, and I'm rather relieved to find that the rest of society has adjusted itself to my perception, that we find your story a little small and boring. So I thought that was one of the signs that Me Too is well and truly over, because she was one of the poster girls. I'm afraid girl, not women. She was definitely a poster girl for Me Too. And that mania was weird because it did start with something legitimate, a legitimate beef. And there were men in positions of power that had abused that power and had raped women or conditioned their promotions on sexual availability. But then that movement accelerated until all females, and I speak for myself, nominally a female, everyone had to have their story. And it had to be a story of abuse. If you didn't have a story of having been abused, then you were just nobody. This was a status symbol. The story was the status. That was the handbag. And it grew incredibly petty and also vengeful, so that people were taking out their grudges or going for figures in positions that made it satisfying to take them down. You know, you knew a famous writer, maybe you'd kissed him once, and then, you know, goodbye Juno Diaz or something. And it brought out the worst in my sex, I'm afraid. And it also portrayed us collectively as weak. And that was the irony, I thought, of the movement, because it was supposed to be about empowerment, about really standing up to men. But I think it in the end, it made us look whiny. And that's because the stories didn't remain about serious violations of women's rights and serious abuse of power. It went to, oh, he brushed up against me and I didn't want it and I thought he was coming on to me. And it also started to be so touchy that it imperiled the ability of men and women to get along with each other, much less to mate with each other and have children and get married and fall in love. All the good stuff was out the window. It imperiled sex. It was pretty crazy there for a while, and it convinced a lot of young men that women weren't worth the bother. They weren't worth the risk. You know, stay home with your porn. It's safe. It's not going to get you into trouble. And I was completely sympathetic with that. And I think that there has also been a hangover of the Me Too movement of just a set of men, young men, who should be out there looking for mates, looking for girlfriends, looking for companionship, looking for sex, who have given up on it because the women are so hysterical. And you never know what you're going to do that's going to set them off, and it might get you into terrible legal trouble. So, you know, just forget it. Forget the whole thing. And I think that is the most damaging consequence to that movement. That, and of course, it did wreck a lot of careers. A few of those people are coming back, not all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I've often thought that it's interesting that lots of feminists complain about porn culture, and I think they raise lots of pertinent complaints about porn culture, but they also maybe unwittingly gave rise to a situation in which porn often seems more attractive to young men in particular than the idea of going out there and taking a risk and asking a girl if she wants a drink or a date or sex. You know, you can't on the one hand atomize the sexes and rip them apart from each other, and then on the other complain about the technological ways in which people pleasure themselves, because there does seem to be, to me anyway, there seems to be a relationship between those two phenomena. Okay, Lionel, my last question for you is, it would be remiss of me not to ask you, given that you are an American person, even though you live most of your time in the UK, what's your view of the upcoming presidential election? Who will you or would you or might you vote for if it's a clash between Trump and Biden? Or is that just so unappealing that you wouldn't get involved at all? What's your take on where American politics is at over the next year?
Actually, I was just grilled on this by a Spectator podcast. It drove me into paralytic incoherence. I am part of the two-thirds of the American public that doesn't want to vote for either one of those characters. And I have an easy out because I'm registered in New York. That's a blue state. It's going to Biden with or without me. Doesn't matter. It's a foregone conclusion. Always goes Democratic. And therefore, I have the luxury, if I want, to vote for RFK Jr. I have to confess, with limited enthusiasm, if nothing else, voting for someone who's not going to be president is not that satisfying. And he has some questionable views. I don't think he's as much of a nut as the New York Times has tried to characterize him. The entire Democratic establishment has tried to portray him as a complete kook. I'm not sure I share his view about MMR vaccines' connection to autism, for example. But he's not crazy, and I don't think it would be shameful to vote for him. However, I just acknowledge that it's kind of cheating, because either Biden or Trump, barring an act of nature, some deus ex machina, or maybe the hand of God reaching down from the sky and picking one or the other of them off the planet. One of them is going to be president. And if I were in a swing state, I would not be able to afford that kind of luxury voting, if we can coin another phrase. And I'm really not sure what I will do. I find it almost impossible to imagine myself voting for Trump, partly because it has been very useful to me in public discourse to establish myself firmly as not a Trump supporter, because that comes with so much baggage. You get lumped with a crowd I don't necessarily want to be lumped with. And I don't like to lie in public either. So if I did vote for Trump, I'd feel that I'd have to confess to it. I hate the idea of voting for Biden. I think the risks with Biden are as great. I am horrified by the idea of his dying in office and leaving us with Kamala Harris, which is in some ways the very worst of consequences. I do not like his far left record. I don't like the racial preferences he's pushed. I found him quite anti-democratic, despite the fact that he's trying to push the idea that, of course, Trump is a threat to democracy. I think they're both threats to democracy. Biden has been heavily behind censorship on an institutionalized level. I have been deeply offended by the fact that his high-handed executive action in terms of forgiving hundreds of billions of dollars of student debt, which, by the way, that's just transferring the debt to the taxpayer. He did that without Congress. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that without Congress. Congress controls the purse strings constitutionally. Sorry, that's null and void. He turns it right around, uses a slightly different legal excuse for doing it, and then carries on forgiving billions and billions of student debt as if the Supreme Court had never ruled on this matter. That makes my skin crawl. I mean, Trump is always a wild card. I did not like the fact that he wouldn't accept the results of the 2020 election. I did not like January 6th, although I don't think it was a serious attempt to overturn the election. I don't like him personally, and I am very sympathetic with people who just want to stay home. So if I were in a swing state, I'm sorry to admit it, and maybe I will come around, and I guess the chances are higher that I will still vote for Biden. But I say that sick to my stomach, and I just think the way forward is pretty grim for the U.S. Either president looks bad to me. Trump looks crazy, and Biden looks weak. You know, so in an international perspective, what's more dangerous? Probably weak. I think it's not an accident that we've seen all these things happening during the Biden administration. He looks frail. He loses his train of thought. He often simply can't talk. I saw a news report, I think it was PBS, just a couple days ago. They used subtitles underneath Biden talking. He's speaking English. But he was his usual kind of mumbly, indiscernible words trailing together, no consonants, and they had to run subtitles. And that tells you a lot. So I don't have an answer for you right now. I don't. But we'll see if something changes between now and November.
That's fair enough. Lionel Shriver, thank you very much.
All right. It's always fun to talk to you, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.